6.
Everything will be spilled, that's certain, said Lucian, again taking possession of the handbag.
She quickly stretched forth her hand and moved her handbag farther away, banging it down on the table as if thereby to underline the interdiction.
You always have to fiddle with something, she said amicably.
Lucian looked at his hand, splaying the fingers and then closing them up again. The nails, tawny with nicotine, had ragged cuticles around them. Fat little furrows ran across the finger joints, and a few hairs grew lower down. He placed his hand on the table next to her hand, milky pale and soft to look at, with short, neatly trimmed nails.
I regret not having known your father, she said after a pause. He must have been very kind, very earnest, and very fond of you.
Lucian was silent.
Tell me some more. How was your life here? Were you really a little boy once, running and romping about?
He replaced both hands on his cane, and from the expression on his face, from the sleepy lowering of his heavy lids and from his slightly open mouth, looking as if he were about to yawn, she concluded that he had grown bored, that he was tired of reminiscing. And anyway, he reminisced coldly. She was puzzled that having lost his father only a month ago, he was now able to look dry-eyed at the hotel where they had lived together during his boyhood. But even in this indifference, in his clumsy words and in the cumbrous stirrings of his soul that seemed to be drowsily turning over and falling asleep again, she fancied she saw something pathetic, a charm that was difficult to define, but one that she had felt in him from the first day of their acquaintance. And how mysterious it was that despite the evident tepidity of his relationship with his father, he had chosen precisely this resort and precisely this hotel, as if expecting to receive from these once-seen objects and landscapes the tingle he was unable to experience without outside assistance. And he had arrived magnificently on a gray and green day in a drizzling rain, wearing a disgraceful black shaggy hat and huge rubbers, and looking through the window at his figure as he clambered ponderously out of the hotel bus, she had felt that this unknown newcomer was someone quite special, unlike any other resident at the resort. That same evening she learned who he was. Everybody in the restaurant looked at this stout, gloomy man who ate greedily and sloppily, and sometimes became lost in thought, one finger stroking the tablecloth. She did not play chess, took no interest in chess tournaments, but somehow or other his name was familiar to her. It had unconsciously imprinted itself in her memory, though she was unable to recall when she had first heard it. A German manufacturer who was a long-time sufferer from constipation and liked to talk about it, a man with a one-track mind, but who was good-natured and pleasant and dressed with some taste, suddenly forgot his constipation, and in the gallery where they were drinking the curative water, informed her of several amazing facts about the gloomy gentleman who now, having exchanged his shaggy fedora for an old boater, was standing before a small display window let into one of the columns and examining some handcrafted knick-knacks that were being exhibited for sale.
"Your fellow countryman," said the manufacturer, indicating him with a jerk of the eyebrow, "is a famous chess player. He has come from Paris for the tournament that will be held in Berlin in 2 months' time. If he wins, he'll challenge the world champion. His father recently died. It's all here in the newspaper."
She wanted to make his acquaintance, talk Russian. So attractive did he seem to her with his uncouthness, his gloominess, and his low turned-down collar, which for some reason made him look like a musician, and she was pleased that he did not take any notice of her and seek an excuse to talk to her, as did all the other single men in the hotel.
She was not particularly pretty. There was something lacking in her small, regular features, as if the last decisive jog that would have made her beautiful, leaving her features the same, but endowing them with an ineffable significance, had not been given them by nature. But she was 25, her fashionably bobbed hair was neat and lovely, and she had one turn of the head which betrayed a hint of possible harmony, a promise of real beauty that at the last moment remained unfulfilled. She wore extremely simple and extremely well-cut dresses that left her arms and neck bare, as if she were flaunting a little their tender freshness. She was rich. Her father had lost a fortune in Russia and made another in Germany. Her mother was due soon at the resort, and since the advent of Luzhin, the thought of her fussy arrival had become unpleasant. She made his acquaintance on the third day after his arrival, made it the way they do in old novels or in motion pictures. She drops a handkerchief and he picks it up, with the sole difference that they interchanged roles. Luzhin was walking along a path in front of her, and in succession shed a large checked handkerchief that was unusually dirty and had all sorts of pocket debris sticking to it, then a broken and crushed cigarette minus half of its contents, a nut, and a French franc. She gathered up only the handkerchief and the coin and walked on, slowly catching up with him and curiously awaiting some new loss. With the cane he carried in his right hand, Luzhin touched in passing every tree trunk and every bench, while groping in his pocket with his left, until finally he stopped, turned out his coat pocket, shed another coin, and started to examine the large hole in the lining.
"Right through," he said in German, taking the handkerchief from her hand.
"This also," she said in Russian.
"Poor material," he continued,
without looking up, neither switching to Russian nor showing any surprise, as if the return of his things had been quite natural.
Don't put them back there,"
she said with a sudden peal of laughter. Only then did he lift his head and glance morosely at her. His puffy gray face with its badly shaven, razor-nicked cheeks acquired a strange expression of bewilderment. He had wonderful eyes. They were narrow, even slightly slanting, and as if sprinkled with dust under their drooping lids. But through that fluffy dust there showed a moist, bluish gleam containing something insane and attractive. "Don't drop them again," she said, and walked away, feeling his glance on her back. That evening, as she entered the restaurant, she could not help smiling at him from afar, and he responded with the same gloomy, crooked half-smile he sometimes bestowed on the hotel cat as it slipped noiselessly along the floor from one table to another. And on the following day, in the hotel garden among the grottos, fountains, and earthenware dwarves, he went up to her and began, in his deep and melancholy voice, to thank her for the handkerchief and the coin. And from that time, dimly and almost unconsciously, he constantly watched to see whether she would drop anything, as if trying to reestablish some secret symmetry.
"Don't mention it. Don't mention it," she replied, and added many similar words,
the poor relations of real words, and how many there are of them, these little throwaway words that are spoken hurriedly and temporarily fill the void. Employing such words, and feeling their petty vapidity, she asked him if he liked the resort, was he there for long, and did he take the waters. He replied that he did, was for long, and took the waters. Then, fully aware of the stupidity of the question, but incapable of stopping herself, she asked how long he had been playing chess. He gave no answer, and turned away. And she felt so embarrassed that she began to reel off a list of all the meteorological indications for yesterday, today, and tomorrow. He continued silent, and she also fell silent,
and then she began to rummage in her handbag, searching agonizingly for a topic, and finding only a broken comb. Suddenly, he turned his face to her and said, 18 years, 3 months, and 4 days. For her, this was an exquisite relief, and furthermore, she was somehow flattered by the elaborate circumstantiality of his reply. Subsequently, however, she began to grow a little annoyed that he, in his turn, never asked any questions, taking her, as it were, for granted. An artist, a great artist, she frequently thought, contemplating his heavy profile, his corpulent, hunched body, the dark lock of hair clinging to his always moist forehead. And perhaps it was precisely because she knew nothing at all about chess, that chess for her was not simply a parlor game or a pleasant pastime, but a mysterious art equal to all the recognized arts. She had never been in close contact with such people. There was no one to compare him with, except those inspired eccentrics, musicians and poets, whose image one knows as clearly and as vaguely as that of a Roman emperor, an inquisitor, or a comedy miser. Her memory contained a modest, dimly lit gallery with a sequence of all the people who had in any way caught her fancy. Here were her school reminiscences, the girls' school in St. Petersburg with an unusual bit of ivy on its frontage that ran along a short, dusty, tramless street, and the geography teacher, who also taught in a boys' school, a large-eyed man with a very white forehead and tousled hair, suffering, they said, from tuberculosis. Once a guest, they said, of the Dalai Lama. In love, they said, with one of the upper-form girls, a niece of the white-haired, blue-eyed headmistress, whose tidy little office was so cozy with its blue wallpaper and white Dutch stove. And it was precisely on a blue background, surrounded by blue air, that the geography teacher had remained in her memory. He would dash noisily into the classroom in his usual impulsive manner, and then melt away and vanish, yielding his place to another person, who also seemed to her unlike all the rest. The appearance of this person was preceded by lengthy admonitions on the part of the headmistress not to laugh, not on any account to laugh. This was the first year of the Soviet regime. Out of 40 pupils in the class, only 17 remained, and every day they met the teachers with the question, "Will there be lessons today?" And the latter invariably replied, "We still haven't received final instructions." The headmistress ordered there to be no giggles when the man came from the commissariat for popular education, whatever he might say and however he might behave himself. And he came and took up his abode in her memory as an extraordinarily amusing person, a visitor from a different, absurd world. He was lame, but very lively and squirmy, with quick, flickering eyes. The girls were crowded in the hushed hall, and he walked back and forth in front of them, limping briskly and turning with simian agility. And as he limped past them, nimbly dragging his foot on its double heel, and with his right hand cutting the air up into regular slices, or else smoothing it out like cloth, he spoke swiftly and at length about the lectures in sociology he would be giving and about an imminent merger with a boys' school. And restrained laughter made one's jaws ache and caused spasms in one's throat. And later, in Finland, which had remained in her heart as something more Russian than Russia, perhaps because the wooden villa and the fir trees and the white boat on the lake, black with the reflected conifers, were especially Russian, being treasured as something forbidden on the far side of the frontier. In this Finland, which was still vacation land, still part of St. Petersburg life, she saw several times from afar a celebrated writer, a very pale man with a very conspicuous goatee, who kept glancing up at the sky, which enemy airplanes had begun to haunt. and he remained in some strange manner beside the Russian officer who subsequently lost an arm in the Crimea during the Civil War, a most shy and retiring boy with whom she used to play tennis in summer and ski in winter. And with this snowy recollection, there would float up once more against a background of night the celebrated writer's villa, in which he later died, and the cleared path and snowdrifts illumined by electric light, phantasmal stripes on the dark snow. These men, with their various occupations, each of whom tinted her recollection his own particular color, blue geographer, khaki commissar, the writer's black overcoat, and a youth all in white lobbing a fir cone with his tennis racket, were followed by glinting and dissolving images, emigre life in Berlin, charity balls, monarchist meetings, and lots of identical people. All this was still so close that her memory was unable to focus properly and sort out what was valuable and what rubbish. And moreover, there was no time now to sort it out. Too much space had been taken up by this taciturn, fabulous, enigmatical man, the most attractive of all the men she had known. His very art, and all the manifestations and signs of this art, were mysterious. She quickly learned that in the evenings after supper he worked until late at night. But this work was beyond the powers of her imagination, since there was nothing to link it to, neither an easel nor a piano, and it was just such a definite emblem of art that her thoughts reached out for. His room was on the first floor, and men with cigars strolling in the darkness of the garden sometimes glimpsed his lamp and his inclined face. Somebody told her finally that he sat at an empty chessboard. She wanted to look for herself, and one night, soon after their first conversation, she made her way along the footpath between the oleander bushes to his window. But feeling a sudden awkwardness, she went straight by without looking, and came out into the avenue, where she could hear music coming from the Kursaal, and then, unable to master her curiosity, she went back again to the window, but this time deliberately making the gravel creak so as to convince herself she was not spying. His window was open, the blind unlowered, and in the bright depth of the room she saw him take off his jacket, tense his neck muscles, and yawn. And in the slow, massive motion of his shoulder, the image of which continued to heave and turn before her eyes as she hastily walked away in the darkness toward the illuminated terrace of the hotel, she fancied the presence of a mighty fatigue after undivulged but surely miraculous labors. Lucian was indeed tired. Lately he had been playing too frequently and too unsystematically. He was particularly fatigued by playing blind, a rather well-paid performance that he willingly gave. He found therein deep enjoyment. One did not have to deal with visible, audible, palpable pieces whose quaint shape and wooden materiality always disturbed him and always seemed to him but the crude mortal shell of exquisite, invisible chess forces. When playing blind, he was able to sense these diverse forces in their original purity. He saw then neither the knight's carved mane nor the glossy heads of the pawns, but he felt quite clearly that this or that imaginary square was occupied by a definite concentrated force, so that he envisioned the movement of a piece as a discharge, a shock, a stroke of lightning, and the whole chess field quivered with tension. And over this tension, he was sovereign, here gathering in and there releasing electric power. Thus he played against 15, 20, 30 opponents, and of course the sheer number of boards told, since it affected the actual playing time, but this physical weariness was nothing compared to the mental fatigue, retribution for the stress and rapture involved in the game itself, which he conducted in a celestial dimension where his tools were incorporeal quantities. He also found a certain solace in these blind games, in the victories they afforded him, for in recent years he had been having no luck at international tournaments. A ghostly barrier had arisen that kept preventing him from coming first. Valentinov had happened to foretell this in the past, shortly before they parted.
"Shine while you can," he had said after that unforgettable tournament in London, the first after the war, when the 20-year-old Russian player came out the victor.
"While you can," repeated Valentinov slyly, "because you won't be a boy prodigy much longer."
And this was very important for Valentinov. He was interested in Luzhin only inasmuch as he remained a freak, an odd phenomenon, somewhat deformed but enchanting, like a dachshund's crooked legs. During the whole time that he lived with Luzhin, he unremittingly encouraged and developed his gift, not bothering for a second about Luzhin as a person, whom, it seemed, not only Valentinov, but life itself, had overlooked. He showed him to wealthy people as an amusing monster, acquired useful contacts through him, and organized innumerable tournaments. And only when he began to suspect that the prodigy was turning simply into a young chess player did he bring him back to his father in Russia. And afterwards, like a kind of valuable, he took him away again when he thought that perhaps he had made a mistake, that the freak still had a year or two of life left in him. When even this span had run out, he made a gift to Luzhin of some money, the way one does to a mistress one has tired of, and disappeared, finding fresh amusement in the movie business, that mysterious astrological business where they read scripts and look for stars. And having departed to the sphere of jaunty, quick-talking, self-important con men with their patter about the philosophy of the screen, the tastes of the masses, and the intimacy of the movie camera, and with pretty good incomes at the same time, he dropped out of Luzhin's world, which, for Luzhin, was a relief, that odd kind of relief you get in resolving an unhappy love affair. He had become attached to Valentinov immediately, as early as the days of his chess tours in Russia, and later he regarded him the way a son might a frivolous, coldish, elusive father to whom one could never say how much one loved him. Valentinov was interested in him only as a chess player. At times he had about him something of the trainer who hovers about an athlete establishing a definite regime with merciless severity. Thus Valentinov asserted that it was all right for a chess player to smoke, since there was in both chess and smoking a touch of the East, but not in any circumstances to drink. And during their life together in the dining rooms of large hotels, enormous hotels deserted in wartime, in chance restaurants, in Swiss inns, and in Italian trattoria, he invariably ordered mineral water for young Luzhin. The food he chose for him was light, so that his brain could function freely. But for some reason, perhaps also because of a hazy connection with the East, he encouraged Luzhin a great deal in his passion for sweets. Finally, he had a peculiar theory that the development of Luzhin's gift for chess was connected with the development of the sexual urge, that, with him, chess represented a special deflection of this urge, and fearing lest Luzhin should squander his precious power in releasing by natural means the beneficial inner tension, he kept him at a distance from women, and rejoiced over his chaste moroseness. There was something degrading in all this. Luzhin, recalling that time, was surprised to note that not a single kind, humane word had passed between him and Valentinov. Nevertheless, when, 3 years after their final departure from Russia, that land which had grown so unpleasant, Valentinov had vanished, he experienced a feeling of emptiness, a lack of support. And then he acknowledged the inevitability of what had happened, sighed, turned around, and again was lost in thought over the chessboard. After the war, tournaments began to increase. He played in Manchester, where the decrepit champion of England forced a draw after a two-day struggle. In Amsterdam, where he lost the deciding game because he exceeded the time limit, and his opponent, with an excited grunt, banged down the stop of Lucien's clock. In Rome, where Turati triumphantly unleashed his celebrated debut, and in many other cities, which for him were all identical, hotel, taxi, a hall in a cafe or club. These cities, these regular rows of blurry lamps marching past and suddenly advancing and encircling a stone horse in a square, were as much a habitual and unnecessary integument as the wooden pieces and the black and white board. And he accepted this external life as something inevitable, but completely uninteresting. Similarly, in his way of dressing and in the manner of his everyday life, he was prompted by extremely dim motives, stopping to think about nothing, rarely changing his linen, automatically winding his watch at night, shaving with the same safety blade until it ceased to cut altogether, and feeding haphazardly and plainly. From some kind of melancholy inertia, he continued to order at dinner the same mineral water, which effervesced slightly in his sinuses, and evoked a tickling sensation in the corners of his eyes, like tears for the vanished Valentinov. Only rarely did he notice his own existence, when, for example, lack of breath, the revenge of a heavy body, forced him to halt with open mouth on a staircase, or when he had toothache, or when, at a late hour during his chess cogitations, an outstretched hand, shaking a matchbox, failed to evoke in it the rattle of matches, and the cigarette that seemed to have been thrust unnoticed into his mouth by someone else suddenly grew and asserted itself solid, soulless, and static, and his whole life became concentrated in the single desire to smoke, although goodness knows how many cigarettes had already been unconsciously consumed. In general, life around him was so opaque and demanded so little effort of him that it sometimes seemed someone, a mysterious, invisible manager, continued to take him from tournament to tournament. But occasionally there were odd moments, such quietness all around, and when you looked out into the corridor, shoes, 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 standing at all the doors, and in your ears, the roar of loneliness. When his father was still alive, Lucien used to think with a sinking feeling about his arrival in Berlin, about the necessity of seeing his father, helping him, talking to him, and this cheerful-looking old man in his knitted waistcoat, clapping him clumsily on the shoulder, was intolerable to him, like a shameful recollection that you try to throw off, screwing up your eyes and moaning through your teeth. He did not come from Paris for his father's funeral, fearing above all corpses, coffins, wreaths, and the responsibility connected with all this. But he came later, set off for the cemetery, tramped around in the rain among the graves and mud-caked rubbers, failed to find his father's grave, and behind some trees caught sight of a man who was probably the caretaker. But a strange feeling of inertia and shyness prevented him from inquiring. He raised his collar and plodded back over a patch of waste ground toward the waiting taxi. His father's death did not interrupt his work. He was getting ready for the Berlin tournament with the definite idea of finding the best defense against the complex opening of the Italian Turati, who was the most awesome of the future participants in the tournament. This player, a representative of the latest fashions in chess, opened the game by moving up on the flanks, leaving the middle of the board unoccupied by pawns, but exercising a most dangerous influence on the center from the sides. Scorning the cozy safety of castling, he strove to create the most unexpected and whimsical interrelations between his men. Lucien had already met him once and lost, And this defeat particularly rankled because Turati, by temperament, by his style of play, and by his proclivity for fantastic arrails, was a player with a kindred mentality to his own. Only Turati had gone farther. Lusion's game, which in his early youth had so astounded the experts with its unprecedented boldness and disregard for the basic, as it seemed, rules of chess, now appeared just a little old-fashioned compared with the glittering extremism of Turati. Lusion's present plight was that of a writer or composer who, having assimilated the latest things in art at the beginning of his active career and caused a temporary sensation with the originality of his devices, all at once notices that a change has imperceptibly taken place around him, that others, sprung from goodness knows where, have left him behind in the very devices where he recently led the way. And then he feels himself robbed, sees only ungrateful imitators in the bold artists who have overtaken him, and seldom understands that he himself is to blame, he who is petrified in his art which was once new but has not advanced since then. Looking back over 18 and more years of chess, Lusion saw an accumulation of victories at the beginning and then a strange lull. Bursts of victories here and there, but in general, irritating and hopeless draws, thanks to which he imperceptibly earned the reputation of a cautious, impenetrable, prosaic player. And this was strange. The bolder his imagination, the livelier his invention during his secret work between matches, the more oppressive became his feeling of helplessness when the contest began, and the more timidly and circumspectly he played. Having long ago entered the ranks of international grandmasters, extremely well-known, cited in all chess textbooks, and candidate among five or six others for the title of world champion, he owed this flattering reputation to his early performances, which had left around him a kind of indistinct light, the halo of the chosen, a haze of glory. His father's death presented itself to him as a landmark by which to measure the road he had traveled. And looking back, he saw with something of a shudder how slowly he had been going of late, and having seen it, he plunged with gloomy passion into new calculations, inventing and already vaguely sensing the harmony of the moves he needed, a dazzling defense. He had been unwell that night in a Berlin hotel after his trip to the cemetery, palpitations of the heart and queer thoughts, and a feeling that his brain had gone numb and been varnished over. The doctor he saw in the morning advised him to take a rest, to go to some quiet place, where there is greenery all around, said the doctor. And Lusion, cancelling a promised display of blind chess, went away to the obvious place which had immediately loomed before him when the doctor referred to greenery. In fact, he felt dimly grateful to an obliging memory that indicated the necessary resort so aptly, took all the trouble on itself, and put him into a ready-made, ready-waiting hotel. He did feel better amid this green scenery that was moderately beautiful and transmitted a feeling of security and tranquility. And suddenly, as in a fairground booth when a painted paper screen is burst starwise admitting a smiling human face, there appeared from no one knew where a person who was so unexpected and so familiar, and who spoke with a voice that seemed to have been sounding mutely all his life, and now had suddenly burst through the usual murk. Trying to unravel in his mind this impression of something very familiar, he recalled quite irrelevantly, but with stunning clarity, the face of a bare-shouldered, black-stockinged young prostitute standing in a lighted doorway in a dark side street in a nameless town. And in some ridiculous way it seemed to him that this was she, that she had come now, primly dressed and somewhat less pretty, as if she had washed off some bewitching makeup, but because of this, had become more accessible. This was his first impression when he saw her, when he noticed with surprise that he was actually talking to her. It irked him a little that she was not quite as good-looking as she might have been, judging by odd, dreamy signs strewn about in his past. He reconciled himself to this and gradually began to forget her vague prototypes, and then he felt reassured and proud that here, talking to him, spending her time with him and smiling at him, was a real, live person. And that day, on the garden terrace, where bright yellow wasps kept settling on the iron tables and moving their lowered antennae, that day when he started to speak of how he had once lived in this hotel as a small boy, Lusion began with a series of quiet moves, the meaning of which he himself only vaguely sensed, his own peculiar declaration of love. "Go on, tell me more," she repeated, despite having noticed how morosely and dully he had fallen silent. He sat leaning on his cane and thinking that with a night's move of this lime tree standing on a sunlit slope, one could take that telegraph pole over there, and simultaneously he tried to remember what exactly he had just been talking about. A waiter with a dozen empty beer mugs hanging from his crooked fingers ran along the wing of the building, and Lusion remembered with relief that he had been speaking about the tournament that once took place in that very wing. He grew agitated and hot, and the band of his hat constricted his temples, and this agitation was not quite comprehensible yet.
"Let's go," he said. "I'll show you. It must be empty there now, and cool."
Stepping heavily and trailing his cane, which grated along the gravel and bounced against the doorstep, he entered the door first. "How ill-bred he is," she reflected, and caught herself shaking her head, and then accused herself of introducing a slightly false note. His manners had nothing at all to do with ill-breeding.
"Here, I think it's this way," said Lusion,
and pushed a side door. A fire was burning, a fat man in white was shouting something, and a tower of plates ran past on human legs.
"No, farther,"
said Lusion, and walked along the corridor. He opened another door, and almost fell, steps going down and some shrubs at the bottom, and a pile of rubbish, and an apprehensive hen, jerkily walking away.
"I made a mistake," said Lusion. "It's probably here to the right."
He removed his hat, feeling burning beads of sweat gather on his brow. Oh, how clear was the image of that cool, empty, spacious hall, and how difficult it was to find it.
"Let's try this door here," he said.
The door proved to be locked. He pressed the handle down several times.
"Who's there?"
a hoarse voice said abruptly, and a bed creaked.
A mistake,
muttered Lusion, and went farther. Then he looked back and stopped. He was alone.
"Where is she?"
he said aloud, shuffling his feet as he turned this way and that. Corridor. Window giving on garden. Gadget on wall with numbered pigeonholes. A bell whirred. In one of the pigeonholes, a number popped up awry. He was bemused and troubled, as if he had lost his way in a bad dream, and he quickly walked back, repeating under his breath,
"Queer jokes, queer jokes."
He came out unexpectedly into the garden, and there two characters were sitting on a bench and looking at him curiously. Suddenly, he heard laughter overhead and raised his face. She was standing on the little balcony of her room and laughing, her elbows propped on the railings, her palms pressed against her cheeks, and shaking her head with sly reproachfulness. She looked at his ample face, the hat on the back of his head, and waited to see what he would do now.
"I couldn't keep up with you," she cried,
straightening up and opening her arms in some kind of explanatory gesture. Lusion lowered his head and entered the building. She supposed that in a moment he would knock on her door, and she decided not to let him in and say the room was untidy. But he did not knock. When she went down to supper, he was not in the dining room. "He's taken offense," she decided, and went to bed earlier than usual. In the morning, she went out for a walk and looked to see if he was waiting in the garden, reading his newspaper on a bench as usual. He was not in the garden, he was not in the gallery, and she went for a walk without him. When he did not appear for dinner and his table was taken by an ancient couple who had long had their eye on it, she asked in the office if Mr. Luzhin was sick.
"Mr. Luzhin left this morning for Berlin," replied the girl.
An hour later, his baggage returned to the hotel. The janitor and a bellboy, with matter-of-fact indifference, carried in the bags which that morning they had carried out. Luzhin was returning from the station on foot, a stout, doleful gentleman crushed by the heat and in shoes white with dust. He rested on all the benches and once or twice plucked a blackberry, grimacing from the sourness. While walking along the highway, he noticed a fair-haired small boy following him with tiny steps, holding an empty beer bottle in his hands, and lagging behind on purpose and staring at him with unbearable childish concentration. Luzhin halted. The boy also halted. Luzhin moved. The boy moved. Then Luzhin lost his temper and threatened him with his cane. The other froze, grinning with surprise and joy.
"Ow!"
said Luzhin in a deep voice, and went toward him, his cane raised. The small boy jumped and ran off. Grumbling to himself and breathing hard through the nose, Luzhin continued on his way. All at once, an extremely well-aimed pebble hit him on the left shoulder blade. He let out a cry and turned around. Nobody. An empty road, woods, heather.
"I'll kill him,"
he said loudly in German, and walked on faster, trying to weave from side to side the way he had read somewhere men do when they fear a shot in the back, and repeating his helpless threat. He was quite exhausted, panting and almost crying by the time he reached the hotel.
"Changed my mind,"
he said, addressing the office grill as he went by.
"I'm staying. Changed my mind."
"She's sure to be in her room," he said as he went up the stairs. He burst in upon her as if he had butted the door with his head, and, dimly catching sight of her reclining in a pink dress on the couch, he said hastily,
"Hello, hello,"
and strode all around the room, supposing that everything was working out very easily, wittily and entertainingly, and simultaneously suffocating with excitement.
"And therefore, in continuance of the above, I have to inform you that you will be my wife. I implore you to agree to this. It was absolutely impossible to go away. Now everything will be different and wonderful."
And at this point, he settled on a chair by the radiator, and, covering his face with his hands, burst into tears. Then, trying to spread one hand so that it covered his face, he began with the other to search for his handkerchief. And through the trembling wet chinks between his fingers, he perceived in duplicate a blurry pink dress that noisily moved toward him.
"Now, now, that's enough, that's enough," she repeated in a soothing voice. "A grown man, and crying like that."
He seized her by the elbow and kissed something hard and cold, her wristwatch. She removed his straw hat and stroked his forehead, and swiftly retreated, evading his clumsy, grabbing movements. Luzhin trumpeted into his handkerchief once, once more, loudly and juicily. Then he wiped his eyes, cheeks, and mouth, and sighed with relief, leaning on the radiator, his moist, bright eyes looking in front of him. It was then that she realized clearly that this man, whether you liked him or not, was not one you could thrust out of your life, that he had sat himself down firmly, solidly, and apparently for a long time. But she also wondered how she could show this man to her father and mother. How could he be visualized in their drawing room, a man of a different dimension, with a particular form and coloring that was compatible with nothing and no one? At first, she tried fitting him this way and that in her family, among their milieu and even among the furnishings of their flat. She made an imaginary illusion enter the rooms, talk with her mother, eat home-cooked kulabiaka, and be reflected in the sumptuous samovar purchased abroad. And these imaginary calls ended with a monstrous catastrophe. Lusion, with a clumsy motion of his shoulder, would knock the house down like a shaky piece of scenery that emitted a sigh of dust. Their apartment was an expensive, well-appointed one on the first floor of an enormous Berlin apartment house. Her parents, rich once more, had decided to start living in strict Russian style, which they somehow associated with ornamental Slavic scriptory, postcards depicting sorrowing boyar maidens, varnished boxes bearing gaudy pyrogravures of troikas or firebirds, and the admirably produced, long-since-expired art magazines containing such wonderful photographs of old Russian manners and porcelain. Her father used to say to his friends that it was particularly pleasant after business meetings and conversations with people of dubious origin to immerse himself in genuine Russian comfort and eat genuine Russian food. At one time, their servant had been a genuine Russian orderly taken from an émigré shelter near Berlin, but for no apparent reason, he became extraordinarily rude and was replaced by a German-Polish girl. The mother, a stately lady with plump arms, used to call herself affectionately an enfant terrible and a Cossack, a result of vague and distorted reminiscences from War and Peace. She played the Russian housewife superbly, had a weakness for theosophy, and denounced the radio as a Jewish invention. She was very kind and very tactless, and sincerely loved the daubed artificial Russia she had rigged up around her. But sometimes she became unbearably bored, not knowing exactly what was missing, for, as she put it, she, for one, had brought her own Russia with her. The daughter was completely indifferent to this gimcrack apartment, so unlike their quiet St. Petersburg house, where the furniture and other things had their own soul, where the icon cabinet harbored an unforgettable garnet gleam, and mysterious orange tree blossoms, where a fat, intelligent cat was embroidered on the silk back of an armchair, and where there were 1,000 trifles, smells, and shades that altogether constituted something ravishing and heartrending and completely irreplaceable. The young Russians who visited them in Berlin considered her a nice but not very interesting girl, while her mother said of her, in a low-pitched voice with a trace of derision, that she represented in the family the intelligentsia and avant-garde literature. Whether because she knew by heart a few poems of the symbolist Balmont that she had found in the poetry reader, or whether for some other reason, remained unknown. Her father liked her independence, her quietness, and her particular way of lowering her eyes when she smiled. But nobody yet had been able to dig down to what was most captivating about her. This was the mysterious ability of her soul to apprehend in life only that which had once attracted and tormented her in childhood, the time when the soul's instinct is infallible, to seek out the amusing and the touching, to feel constantly an intolerable tender pity for the creature whose life is helpless and unhappy, to feel across hundreds of miles that somewhere in Sicily a thin-legged little donkey with a shaggy belly is being brutally beaten. Whenever she did come across a creature that was being hurt, she experienced a kind of legendary eclipse, when inexplicable night comes down and ash flies and blood appears on the walls, and it seems that if at once she did not help, did not cut short another's torture, the existence of which it was absolutely impossible to explain in a world so conducive to happiness, her heart would not stand it, and she would die. Hence, she lived in perpetual, secret agitation, constantly anticipating a new delight or a new pity, and it was said of her that she adored dogs and was always ready to lend money, and listening to these trivial rumors, she felt as she had in childhood during that game where you go out of the room and the others talk about you, and you have to guess who said what. And among the players, among those whom she joined after a stay in the next room, where you sat waiting to be called and conscientiously sang something so as not to overhear, or else opened a chance book, and like a jack-in-the-box, a passage from a novel would spring up, the end of an unintelligible conversation, among those people whose opinion she had to guess, there was now a rather taciturn man, difficult to budge, and thinking completely unknown things about her. She suspected that he had no opinion at all, that he had no conception whatsoever of her milieu or the circumstances of her life, and so might blurt out something dreadful. Deciding that she had been absent long enough, she gently passed her hand over the back of her head, smoothing down her hair, and returned, smiling, to the lobby. Lucian and her mother, whom she had only just introduced to one another, were sitting in wicker armchairs beneath a potted palmetto, and Lucian, his brows knitted, was examining his disgraceful straw hat which he was holding in his lap, and at that moment she was equally terrified by the thought of what words Lucian was using about her, if indeed he was using any, and the thought of what impression Lucian himself was making on her mother. The day before, as soon as her mother had arrived and begun to complain that her window faced north and the bedside lamp was not working, the daughter had related, trying to keep all her words on the same level, how she had become great friends with the famous chess player Lucian. "No doubt a pseudonym," said her mother, burrowing in her toilet case. "His real name is Rubenstein or Abramson." "Very, very famous," continued the daughter, "and very nice." "Help me rather to find my soap," said her mother. And now, having introduced them and left them alone on the pretext of ordering some lemonade, she experienced, as she returned to the lobby, such a feeling of horror, of the irreparability of already completed catastrophes, that while still some distance away, she began to speak loudly, then tripped on the edge of the carpet and laughed, waving her hands to keep her balance. His senseless fiddling with the boder, the silence, her mother's amazed, gleaming eyes, and the sudden recollection of how he had sobbed the other day, his arms round the radiator, all this was very hard to bear. But suddenly Lucian raised his head, his mouth twisted into that familiar morose smile, and at once her fear vanished, and the potential disaster seemed something that was extraordinarily amusing, changing nothing. As if he had waited for her return in order to retire, Lucian grunted, stood up, and gave a remarkable nod. "Boorish," she thought gaily, translating this nod into her mother's idiom, before proceeding toward the staircase. On the way, he met the waiter bringing three glasses of lemonade on a tray. He stopped him, took one of the glasses, and holding it carefully in front of him, mimicking the swaying level of the liquid with his eyebrows, began slowly to mount the stairs. When he had disappeared round the bend, she began with exaggerated care to peel the thin paper from her straw. "What a boor!" said her mother loudly, and the daughter felt the kind of satisfaction you get when you find in the dictionary the meaning of a foreign term you have already guessed. "That's not a real person," continued her mother in angry perplexity. "What is he? Certainly not a real person. He calls me Madame, just Madame, like a shop assistant. He's God knows what, and I'll guarantee he has a Soviet passport. A Bolshevik, just a Bolshevik. I sat there like an idiot, and his small talk, his cuffs are quite soiled, by the way, did you notice? Soiled and frayed." "What kind of small talk?" she asked, smiling from beneath lowered brows. Yes, madame. No, madame. There's a nice atmosphere here. Atmosphere? Quite a word, eh? I asked him, to say something, if it was long since he had left Russia. He simply was silent. Then he remarked about you that you like cooling beverages. Cooling beverages. And what a mug, what a mug. No, no, let us steer clear of such characters.
Continuing the game of opinions, she hastened to Luzhin. In the course of his botched departure, his room had been given to someone else, and he had been assigned to another one higher up. He was sitting with his elbows on the table, as if grief-stricken, and in the ashtray an insufficiently stubbed cigarette was struggling to send up smoke. On the table and floor were scattered sheets of paper covered with writing in pencil. For a second, she thought they were bills, and she wondered at their number. The wind blowing in through the open window gusted as she opened the door, and Luzhin, coming out of his reverie, picked up the sheets of paper from the floor and neatly folded them, smiling at her and blinking.
"Well, how did it go?" she asked.
"It'll take shape during the game," said Luzhin. "I'm simply jotting down a few possibilities."
She had the feeling she had opened the wrong door, entered where she had not intended to enter. But it was nice in this unexpected world, and she did not want to go to that other one where the game of opinions was played. But instead of continuing to talk about chess, Luzhin moved up to her together with his chair, grasped her by the waist with hands shaking from tenderness, and not knowing what to undertake, attempted to seat her on his knees. She pushed her hands against his shoulders and averted her face, pretending to look at the sheets of paper.
"What's that?" she asked.
"Nothing, nothing," said Luzhin. "Notes on various games."
"Let me go!" she demanded in a shrill voice.
"Notes on various games, notes,"
repeated Luzhin, pressing her to him, his narrowed eyes looking up at her neck. A sudden spasm distorted his face, and for an instant his eyes lost all expression. Then his features relaxed oddly, his hands unclenched of themselves, and she moved away from him, angry, without knowing exactly why she was angry, and surprised that he had let her go. Luzhin cleared his throat and greedily lit a cigarette, watching her with incomprehensible mischievousness.
"I'm sorry I came," she said. "First, I interrupted your work."
"Not a bit of it,"
replied Luzhin with unexpected merriment, and slapped his knees.
"Second, I wanted to get your impressions."
"A lady of high society," answered Luzhin. "You can see that right away."
"Listen," she exclaimed, continuing to be cross, "were you ever educated? Where did you go to school? Have you ever met people at all? Talked to people?"
"I've voyaged a great deal," said Luzhin. "Here and there, everywhere a little bit."
"Where am I? Who is he? What next?"
she asked herself mentally, and looked round at the room, the table covered with sheets of paper, the crumpled bed, the wash basin, on which a rusty safety blade had been left lying, and a half-open drawer from which, snake-like, a green red-spotted tie came crawling. And in the middle of this bleak disorder sat the most unfathomable of men, a man who occupied himself with a spectral art. And she tried to stop, to grasp at all his failings and peculiarities, to tell herself once for all that this man was not the right one for her. And at the same time, she was quite distinctly worried about how he would behave in church and how he would look in tails.